a special education teacher, an administrator, and a lawyer walk into a bar. And our conversations can get pretty lively. And now you'll join us while we talk all about special education and the public school system. I'm Robin Fabiano, a special education teacher and a building-based student services administrator, and I'm joined by Abby Hanscom, a district-level student services administrator, and Angela Smagula, a founding partner at Kahn & Smagula, specializing in education law. We've been working together across multiple districts since 2009 and have lots of opinions about special education. In this podcast, we hope to share information, lessons learned, interviews with VIPs in the field of special education, and bring some humor to an otherwise serious topic. But before we get started, three disclaimers. One, the views shared on this podcast are our own and don't represent the views of the districts in which we work. Two, everyone might want Kahn and Smagula as their attorneys, but Angela is not giving legal advice during this podcast. Three, although there are federal laws governing special education, we work in Massachusetts, a state that has added protections, so some of which we speak about may not apply in your state. So let's get started. Hi, Angela. Hi, Abby.
Hey, Robin.
Hi, Robin. Hi, Abby.
How's it going?
Terrific.
Really great.
I feel like I started the last podcast with the exact same opening. I'm going to have to get a little bit more interesting. Social greeters, right?
Yeah. Welcome to our podcast. Today is January 30th,
2020. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it will come out next week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone like our recording schedule. So we record 1 week out. I was just interviewed for a podcast, and the guy is interviewing, you know, lots of people, and I won't even air until March.
Yeah. I mean, that's because probably he has like a fancy production company, and our fancy production company is named Robin Fabiano.
Correct. That is true. In fact, he did actually. He had a middleman who stepped in and out. His recording had a timer on it, and they checked sound and they did all of that stuff. It was pretty fancy.
I mean, I wonder at the end of the day, though, if it just sounds as good as the Robin Fabiano special.
We'll find out in March, I guess.
Yeah, we will.
Did you talk about special ed?
I did. I talked about the impact on mental health and the economy. I mean, I think of in the sense that I think about people with disabilities getting jobs and outcomes post-secondary, but I don't think about the impact of people with mental health and how it impacts us as consumers. So people who are not able to sustain jobs or buy homes or, you know, lead fulfilling lives with relationships and move out of their homes and blah, blah, blah. And like the impact on the economy. And that conversation resulted out of an article in Barron's. And this was a financial podcast, but I was really doing like the mental health piece.
That's so cool.
That sounds super interesting.
Yeah. It's kind of cool.
Let us know when you air. We can do like a little cross tab, like infomercial.
Totally. Totally. We were looking at an article that was published in September, so the beginning of the school year, and it predicted like the top 10 special education issues for 23-24. And we felt like we're in the middle of the school year. In fact, there's like exactly 18 weeks left. And I know that because we just started semester two at my high school that I work at. And so we're on the downslope. And we thought we would check in and see if they were right. And I guess I'm curious. Oh, I wish you guys didn't read the article, because I would ask you like what you predicted was the number one issue. What would be your number one issue?
So for me, as a special ed administrator, my number one issue has got to be the crazy hiring dynamics. So I was in school committee like in September, October, kind of trying to move the chess pieces around because people had not filled jobs in July and August as we were used to. And I said something like, this is a fundamentally distorted hiring environment. And the school committee person was like, I'm sorry, can you say that again? Like, what do you exactly mean? And I was like, I mean what I just said, like fundamentally distorted hiring environment. And I thought maybe I had overstated or overreacted in that early part of the year, but I really don't think I have. Like, I feel that that kind of dynamic has continued through the year. It's not as bad right now, mostly because we've like had time to kind of chip away at it. And our current fill rate is pretty solid, but we still have people quitting mid-year with no notice, which is a dynamic we've never seen in public school. And is horrendously disruptive to kids and parents and colleagues. And certainly between that and just like the dearth of candidates, if you post a job, you might get two or three candidates instead of 30, 40, 60, 80, is really, really different. And I'm not sure that it's resolving because it's been like a year now or a year and a half. And that is changing kind of how we think about jobs because I'm less inclined to go fight for a new job if I have zero likelihood of filling it. And I'm much more likely to think about what else can we do? Can we add something some other way? Because depending on a fresh new person may not be my like quickest, best answer anymore. And it always used to be.
I'll just tack on to that, that this is the time of year where what we call an education world, February letters are due. And that's like a signal to non-PTS or non-professional status teachers that you may not be rehired. And it makes me think twice about issuing February letters because I don't think I'm going to be able to find someone to fill the position. And I think to myself, what professional development and what work can I do to improve the candidate that I have versus starting fresh? And that's an interesting dynamic to be in.
I would agree. And, you know, I certainly always try to offer like retraining or additional support before we go to that level. But my experience so far is that by giving people even what we would consider moderate constructive feedback, they just leave. They're not interested. Yeah. And so frankly, I'm not willing to not do that because I think that that just dilutes the quality of instruction for kids. So that's reality. But I do think that's going to be a dynamic for the next, you know, year or two.
So not surprisingly, that is their number one issue. So that came up. So Abby, you are right on trend.
That is not a trend I'd like to be on, Robin.
Right. I was speaking with our director of clinical services today because we were at a conservative Jewish school talking about our proportional share contributions. And their number one issue was finding counselors. And they're looking for really specific counselors, you know, gender specific, culture specific, et cetera. And he was saying that for clinical psychologists, most of them are trained to work with adults. And there's a real desert of clinical psychologists available to work with children, even coming up the pipeline. And we also kind of realized that for many people who are in private land, working from home during COVID was really like fulfilling and enticing. And like, why are they spending money on rents or offices where they can provide virtual services? And to do that for kids is really, really hard. And so many of them are shifted their practice to work with adults, and we're finding this real, you know, lack of clinical supports to work with kids. And he was saying that even in their prep programs, it doesn't seem like pipeline is generating potentially new people, which is kind of scary.
Working with kids was always the fun part of the field, right? And the engaging and energizing part. But I think that it's very unfortunate. And I guess it really does call into question, like, you know, if your financial analysis is the determinant of your professional career, that's, you know, going to limit you, right? Because it is cheaper to probably be a virtual therapist. But, you know, if you're five, you probably need the person to be present. And that's where schools really shine because people are present and with kids. And it's challenging, certainly, but you know, orders of magnitude more impactful, which is great.
Well, that was super uplifting. I have a feeling this is going to be a real positive podcast. Angela, this is the next one is for you. So number two, compensatory services. which was surprising to me because I feel like we have exited the COVID compensatory service world. They're predicting that compensatory services are still going to be super hot this year. And I'm curious what you're finding, and maybe it would be helpful to just do a quick like summary of compensatory services.
I agree with you. Like, I don't think COVID compensatory is a thing this year. I have a little bit of it, but not a ton. But the I think the point of that number two is that learning about COVID compensatory has now made parents more aware that compensatory services exist when you miss. And so, and I think that's true now. And so there, you know, we fall into sort of the next bucket of like a misunderstanding of what compensatory services are. So districts need to be clear about when compensatory services are owed. And I always advise to be proactive about that, not wait for the squeaky wheel. But if compensatory services are owed, to be, you know, transparent and forthcoming about that. But then the little piece that's a little bit of a push-pull is that it's not 100%. So like, you don't get if you're owed, you know, 100 hours of X, you don't get 100 hours of X. It's a sort of a negotiation about like time in the day and time in the child's life in a set period of time. Like, you're not going to be doing compensatory services that were owed in second grade in ninth grade, right? So I've found that to be true. And in not all of my districts, but some of my districts. And I wouldn't put it as like the hot issue, though. I was going to say my issue was dovetailing with what some of the stuff you guys were talking about in teachers quitting is the mental health sort of crisis that we're in post-COVID. But I think that's further down on the list.
That's only number three. So you're not off the mark. But I was also surprised that compensatory services were higher than student behaviors because not only what I'm experiencing myself on the day-to-day, what my teacher colleagues are reporting, but also like online, what, you know, of all of the teachers and, you know, teacher accounts and educational accounts that I follow, like student behavior and student mental health, and I guess I should separate them, is like the hottest topic and the highest critical concern. And I think probably managing student behavior even tops mental health these days.
Yeah, people have been tuned into compensatory from COVID, and they are rightfully, you know, keeping track of that and more tuned in. And I think that's not a bad thing. To Angela's point, this like one for one mentality probably isn't accurate or going to serve anybody well. But I know there's like an increase in complaints about those kind of things. And it'll be just really interesting to see what like the larger organizational systems say about it, because there are so many days and weeks available to us, and we do have to make choices about what kids are doing, right? And there are required parts and unrequired parts. So I think we can let that one be because we're going to watch it as a topic. But the mental health / you know, behavioral health kind of world is definitely still like in full effect.
Yeah. I mean, what I was going to say is that we talked about this, like if we went back and listened to some of our old episodes around COVID and post-COVID, I think we'd hear about it. But, you know, essentially students in certain grades missed like critical time in a building for social development. So, you know, so the first full year out of COVID, which is the 21-22 school year, right? I'm framing this because my son was a senior that year. That was like 100% in person, like back to school. That year for kids, like everyone was adjusting being back in a space with and learning in a space with other kids. And so there was an adjustment period there. But everyone kept saying during that year, like, wow, like, you know, we're seeing a lot of, you know, behaviors. But like everyone was trying to kind of just continue to kind of get their shit together. right? So like first year back, you know, still sort of like uneven. And then last year, my son, my other son is a freshman, and you're hearing a lot of noise about, oh, like the this cohort of freshmen, like they missed a lot of the middle school pieces. So the behavior in ninth grade was being reported back as like really like seventh grade behavior. Like, and I had this with a lot of clients too, like a lot of touching, like a lot of excess, like inappropriate, like just banging into each other and touching each other. And like also like losing temper really quickly, right? So all of these things that used to be like a handful of kids ended up being like entire grades of kids, right? That didn't know how to socially interact, in addition to having the pressure of having regular 9-to-5 school. So now we are in like, now we're in 23, 24, like arguably like, like COVID's in the rearview mirror. Like people still get COVID. Nobody cares anymore. Right. Like we all just like power through and we're having regular days and we're counting snow days and we're watching other news stories, but behavior is like off the charts, like off the charts. My theory on this, and Robin, you can cut all this if you want. My theory on this is that people have become kind of like inured to what's happening. And so like behaviors that used to be course correctable and people like take the time and energy to course correct, like have just kind of gone under the radar, and we're dealing with like bigger, larger issues, which is not really helpful to the culture or the community of the building. I see this primarily in middle school, because the kids that are in middle school now in like sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, like they missed like the elementary transition to middle school, right? So everyone missed these big transitions, no matter where you fall on the map. And it's taking a couple years to like cycle it through. And then you put student behavior and you overlap that with like this general mental health crisis, which can be attributable to a lot of things. And you just have a lot of student behavior that's tipping schools in on like an axis that they're not used to, I think.
I'm finding, and we'll connect this with number four, which is the pressure to reduce suspensions, is that I think that schools have a lack of consequences that are meaningful for students these days. And that could be because they don't care if they get a suspension or a detention or an in-school or, you know, have to apologize or lose a privilege. They don't care because they're going to go out with their friends after anyway. You know, there isn't reinforcement, like their phone's not going to be taken away, or their access to wherever isn't going to be interrupted, right? And so I find that there's a lack of consequences and options to give to kids, and restorative justice only solves so much. And if you have a kid like, say, F you to the teacher, or you know, F you and threaten a kid in like a public space, and you try to do restorative justice, it's like the next day they're still saying it. Even if you give them a detention, the next day they're still saying it. Like they don't care what the consequence is. And it's hard to find that match of, you know, what will motivate the student to change their behavior. And right now it's not much, because they're getting a lot of feedback from like socially and from their phones and from TikTok and all of this stuff. And like that seems to be more motivating than like sitting and doing well at school. And that was some of that, what I talked about on the podcast that I was recording in, was like, there's such anxiety about like what's coming next for them, that kids are just avoiding it by like acting out, you know, avoiding the whole next move into adulthood, I think. I don't know. It's my theory.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting, the restorative justice piece, like that also requires time and energy and space in the community. And training in your school community.
Right.
So you can't just say like, you know, let's do restorative justice when you have no baseline community norm. I mean, it has to kind of launch and like infiltrate itself through the building in order to use that. So like, you know, in Massachusetts, like DESE wants us to use all these alternative measures short of suspension, which is good. Many of them require a lot of buy-in and work to be done before those are used in a way that are helpful to course correct the behavior, right? Because I, you know, the idea of school discipline is to course correct the behavior for the community and for the individual. So it's a little bit of a pickle.
Well, I think it's bigger than that. I mean, I do think that the true fact is that school discipline, as we grew up experiencing it as teenagers in the 80s, is probably not the same thing anymore. And so people just need to kind of wrap their brain around that. And
but it's people who grew up in the 80s who are delivering the consequences. And so like, that's what
I know. And so I do think there's a lag every, you know, generation, right? Where certainly our experience of high school is better than probably the people's experience in the 50s, right? So that's real. But, you know, restorative justice is a research-based model that does change school culture and climate for the better. That's real. The problem, of course, is like all things that really create change, they're slow, they're incremental, they take deep, deep, deep training and like continuity. And so I think from my vantage point, seeing this on the list, I was like, obviously, but also like, that's a good reminder that we have to do that more year over year over year if we really want to see like an impact. And that's okay. You have to be in it for the long haul, right? It's easy to suspend a person and then everybody sees that kid isn't in school the next day. But the problem is, you know, if it's really like a 2 week, 3 week, 6 month time frame for change, it's harder for everyone to tolerate that, parents, kids, staff. So I think that's just a big change in our field, and probably a good change in our field because we are teachers educating people who are the future humans. But it is certainly not immediate, like, reinforcing, that's for sure.
Were you surprised to see this on the list of special education trends? Because I feel like this is a general education initiative.
100%. And I think it's just because students with disabilities are disproportionately represented in the suspension ranks, but also the people that are called on to help those culture changes are people in our field, right? Mm. It's adjustment counselor, social worker, guidance counselor, the special ed teacher who says, like, have we thought about it differently? The school administrator, the person, you know, who's the special ed administrator saying, like, what if we tried this? Like, all of that is really what's called for. And I think people in our field are well positioned to do that more, but they can't do it for their colleagues in general. We have to do it with them. And that's, you know, that's a lot of work.
So number five reads kind of funny in the article, but I think it speaks to this idea that transition students, 18 to 22, students who are extending their eligibility, or students whose families feel like they're not ready to end their eligibility and confer their diploma, is something that is likely to increase. Part of that, I think, Angela, is what you're talking about before around like the impact of COVID. I think also, we're seeing parents saying, like, my kid doesn't have any direction. They don't want to go to college, and I'm not sure what they're going to do. So, you know, we want transition services, and we don't want them to take their diploma. And then we're also seeing students who are, you know, not accruing the credits at the same rate as they did before because of school refusal, absenteeism, any number of reasons of not accruing credits at the same rate. And so they're not able to graduate in 4 years. So this chunk of students who are extending their eligibility is going to really be a financial conundrum for districts who are expecting those students to graduate and, you know, enter a new class.
I think that's true. And it probably is a good big idea just to think about the fact that whatever your district's 18 to 22 program currently might expand, you know, it might double in the next 5 years, something like that. And that's not an unrealistic reality. The interesting piece from the list, and we'll put it up in the pod notes, was this idea that for some states, they interpreted the IDEA law to basically be like, you only had rights to stay through the school year you turned 21. And so that was like the strange interpretation. And it got clarified recently that for those states, what the law really means is to the day of your 22nd birthday. And so that's good because that's consistent with Massachusetts. So that's, you know, more consistent.
Yeah. So that's, I think that's right. So that's what the New York, I just read the more of the New York stuff. So like the IDEA goes through 21. Massachusetts is to 22, chapter 688. And so now there was that sort of not 100% clear, right? What it means to turn 21 and do you still have services during the year that you turn 21? And now they're saying it's 22 for this New York, Connecticut sort of area. And
yeah, it's good to be consistent. Those are states like directly touching Massachusetts. Yeah. So it's good that that's consistent so that, you know, kids in this region are experiencing kind of a similar pipeline of service delivery.
Okay, next one is an increase in IEE evaluations. So independent educational evaluation requests. I'm actually not seeing that on my side. I'm curious if you guys are. I'm seeing, and I actually saw a lot of people conducting their own outside neuropsychs and bringing them in for the district to consider. But I'm not seeing a lot of requests for independent evaluation.
Okay. So for the 16 months after you have an evaluation, you have the capacity as a parent to say, I'm no longer satisfied with the evaluation. And it, I believe, has to be because it's either not comprehensive or complete. However, historically, parents haven't said that. They've said, I just don't feel like it's consistent with my student, or I don't feel like you got the whole picture, or I disagree with your recommendations and your findings. And certainly the IEE process is very complicated and very complex, and it is never satisfying to anyone who ever goes through it. However, what I've seen is an uptick in people who are willing to go through it, even if they end up at the end of that process with less funding from the public than they thought they would have at the beginning. And I do think it's a piece of kind of the outside testing, private agencies kind of coming back online post-COVID. And really, you know, I got an email today where the place was like at the bottom of the email, they were coaching the parents in what to write in the email to me. And it just happened to be like attached into the email thread of what to say and how to say it to request funding. And I wrote back, even though I could see the whole chain, and said, sounds like you're requesting public funding. And here are the parameters. And I just need to explain to you that you may or may not be satisfied with like the funding amount and all of those things, but we'll engage with you in it. And so that's probably, you know, I've had double the amount that I ever had in any other year, just this year. And I really don't know to what end. So I do have to say, by the time these things come through the pipeline, the student is like a different student. You know, it's 6 months later and we're happy to receive it. But again, the school district really is only obligated to consider it. And quite frankly, usually our data is more current and more complete than what we're receiving. And so I think sometimes it's kind of like a, I don't know, it's like a false hope that this one document will change everything. And it rarely does in reality.
I think the next one on the list is an interesting one, Robin, which is that students viewed as a threat to others. So my take on this is that there's a much shorter leash, like less patience people have for alleged dangerous or threats to others, and that everyone feels like they can jump in and make decisions about what's best for the student and or the school and or the classroom that the student belongs in. So I think that this is also impacted by COVID, because everyone, you know, became like a warrior behind their screen. So everyone likes to weigh in explicitly about what should be done and how it should be done. And I think that it's difficult to label a student, you know, dangerous or unsafe enough not to come to school. So that's a high, high bar. Everyone outside of the school system thinks it's a low, low bar. And it's, you know, schools, and you guys have done this, and I've done this with you, and I am doing this quite a bit this year. Like, you know, you work collaboratively with families and their outside providers to get assurances that people are safe to come to school. And at the end of the day, if you don't feel that's the case, then you make certain decisions to remove kids from school. But I think it's a very, it's like a high wire act right now. It's pretty tricky. I think school districts do a good job of, you know, doing, weighing everyone's due process rights and also the safety of the building, but it's not as easy as everyone else thinks it is in terms of just yanking someone out of school.
Do you think the threats are higher or people's thresholds are lower?
Lower. I think people's thresholds are lower.
I totally agree. I actually think kids are a little bit more operational and trying to like get through school, and we're seeing less of that kind of explosive behavior for big kids, or the provocative kind of stuff. But that's just my experience. But I would say that people's threshold is lower. And that is where really good, thoughtful safety assessments come in, screenings, all of that. And, you know, the true reality is that there will be some kids who are not safe to be in school, and people have to have the courage to document that and move on and do what needs to happen. And that's all of our responsibility. And then for most kids, they can be in school. They just need a lot of support. And a lot of support means people, time, energy, you know, all of that. And that's a lot. So I am not surprised that that kind of popped up as an issue, because it kind of relates to the other stuff we were talking about with restorative justice. It's just like a big push, and that's kind of what's needed.
Number eight, I'm not sure I totally agree with either. Greater pressure to mainstream students with disabilities. I mean, again, maybe because we're in Massachusetts and, you know, many of our programs are, you know, least restrictive first, and the options for access to general education is extremely high. But I don't see a push for students who really do require substantially separate settings or even partial inclusions to be in mainstream or be in inclusion settings at the expense of like their skill and ability. I don't know if I'm explaining that correctly, but
no, I think this is like a frolic and a detour in Massachusetts. Like that just doesn't, that's like not happening.
I'm hoping it's like a friendly reminder to people that, right, like access to the general education and least restrictive is the first consideration. Sometimes that least restrictive environment is a substantially separate program or a therapeutic placement for some students, but for the majority, right, we want to, you know, we want to make sure that we exhaust all potential supplementary aids and services and supports before removing students for that access. I think that's like a non-issue in Massachusetts, and I probably would not have stuck this on my list of, you know, top 10.
Yeah.
It's not accurate for the 50 states, right? So there are large class action suits in other states to segregate special ed, right? And to pull special ed into inclusive contexts. And so I think we're lucky we're in a tiny little state that has done much of that work. But there are certainly places where substantially separate programming for people with disabilities is still like the go-to answer. But I do think even if we don't think about it for Massachusetts, the reality is the employment worldscape is still very segregated. And so we can still think about it for like outcomes for, you know, 18 to 22, because that's where our work is, I think, a lot.
That's a good point, actually. So I think the last two, Robin, I'm taking over as the moderator, Robin.
That's okay.
So number nine is service animals, which is like, I don't think it's like a massively hot topic for 23, 24. Like it's service animals are fun to talk about, and the actual law around whether a child can have a service animal is pretty tight. So like if you have a student that has a disability and there's an animal that's necessary for the disability, and that animal is trained to perform a task, like you can't, there's not a lot of questions that you can ask about that. Like it's pretty straightforward, and it is sort of like a fun topic to talk about, you know? But I don't think it's like a hot issue for 23, 24. But 10, I think actually is the reading instruction. I would normally defer to you guys to talk about that, because like instruction is like way low down. And like, I get brought into instruction when there's like a problem on the grid or whatever. I'm not usually weighing in on how someone should get their services, but this is a real-time thing happening in a lot of my districts where the demand from like outside reports is for a reading specialist, no matter like what, like for everybody, everyone needs more reading and better reading, and whatever is being taught in school is not sufficient. Regardless of your disability, and you need one-to-one reading instruction. And like I see team meetings blow up about this quite a bit this year, actually. Would you guys agree?
Yeah, I would probably put this as number three. I think I would have done like One was the teacher shortage. Two is like mental health and behavioral. And then three is reading. I think that would be my order.
What about you, Abby?
Yeah. So because I'm in a K-12 position, I'm like inundated with the reading thing, right?
I actually have a great article that Greg Hooray just sent me. I was asking him some research questions about specific reading programs, and he sent me this really cool article, but talks about the science of reading and then actually talks about additional components that are not discussed in the science of reading, such as like motivation, the executive functioning skills that are required to read and comprehend. So there were like five components that need to be included in a comprehensive reading program, where most people are just talking about like decoding, like comprehension.
That's awesome. And I think, so like every pendulum in education, things reach their, you know, whatever that is, you know, farthest point, and then they start to cycle back. And so what you're starting to get is the counter narrative on the science of reading, which looks something like what you're talking about, which is, do the children enjoy reading? Do they consider themselves readers? Do they choose to read? As well as kind of a culturally responsive response as well, critique. And so it'll be really interesting to watch to see if the purely kind of like MRI of your brain argument can withstand that larger set of kind of more humanistic critique. And I don't know if it can or not. Certainly in my experience, I've had kids who have been slow to read for lots of different reasons that were not about their brain MRI as much as about the fact that maybe they had family issues, personal issues, other disability issues, all of those things together that conferred like a delay in acquiring reading, which I don't think the MRI analysis fully, you know, contemplates. That being said, we should be able to teach people to read. And if we can't, we should figure that out as a field. So I think both things are kind of valid. But we're seeing it all the time and just doing a lot of hard work educating staff so that they can do a good job by kids, but also respond to parents' anxiety. Because every time there's a new New York Times article, we get three more requests for evals where the student is clearly not eligible. And that's a huge drain on our resources and time for what would have been time and resources directed towards students who clearly do have disabilities. And that's unfortunate. It's an unfortunate like consequence of the whole process.
Isn't there like a big shift in Massachusetts for different, like for a different approach to reading right now? Or did I make that up?
Districts are required to use a research-based curriculum. And the research-based curriculum these days, it essentially speaks to decoding and like non-level text. And so some districts are moving in that direction, some districts are not. And our governor just set aside like $500 million. Maybe I'm making that number up. Maybe that's too large. To
30 million.
Oh, 30 million. Yeah, 530, same thing. You get that big. But to help districts purchase curriculum materials that fit the requirements of the science of reading. So I think you're right, Ange. Anything else as we're wrapping up? Any other hot topic that you thought should be on the list that isn't?
No, I guess my only interest is like keeping the joy and fun in kind of being a teacher and being an administrator and school culture and not kind of, you know, driving that to the ground. I had somebody, I was in a meeting this week and somebody said like, I know it's just been a terrible year and you're overwhelmed. And I was like, oh, I'm neither overwhelmed nor has it been a terrible year. Like, I'm not sure where your narrative is coming from. And it was like confusing to the person that I said that back to them. And so I think there is something to be said for kind of managing our own anxiety, but also supporting people to, you know, note the positives and the wins and all the good stuff that's happening.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's super important because there's like a teacher shortage, right? You want to have people happy in their job and you want to have people see people happy in their job so that they continue to want to go into teaching, right? You guys are happy and I'm happy and we're happy during this podcast. So, you know, we want to end on a positive note. And I think, you know, the things that are like hot topics for this year, like everyone's working on in a way that's productive, right? We're not sort of saying like it's a lost cause.
Oh, I agree. I think our hot topics are totally manageable and a work in progress. We will be back next week. As always, thanks so much for listening.
Thank you.
Abby, Andrew, it was great to be with you tonight, and we will be back soon.
See you guys later.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating or review. If you have any questions, you can reach us at astalpodcast@gmail.com.